at all.
May it please the court, John Meyer on behalf of the defendant Angelo Cassano. This morning I will confine my argument to the one issue of prosecutorial misconduct and stand on the defendant's brief as far as the other issues. As far as an overview of my position or the defendant's position on prosecutorial misconduct, it's our position that the government misstated both the facts and the law in their closing arguments. In essence, the government had a highly circumstantial case against Mr. Cassano, and Mr. Cassano had a viable defense to the charges that were lodged against him. However, the government used its closing arguments to reconstruct the evidence, to unfairly reconstruct the evidence, and its burden of proof. And what they did is they turned a close case into a seemingly overwhelming one by their closing arguments.
Did you have an opportunity to reply to it?
In as much as some of the misstatements occurred in the government's rebuttal argument, and I would say some of the most egregious misstatements occurred in the government's rebuttal argument, I had no opportunity to counter those.
And you're focusing on the rebuttal argument only?
No, as far as the brief, we focused on both the government summation and the rebuttal, and today I'm focusing on both the summation and rebuttal as far as misstatements and improper argument. The evidence in this case was that Mr. Cassano cashed $300,000 of checks for a friend. And the evidence introduced at trial indicated that Mr. Cassano was led to believe that he was negotiating checks for a friend of a friend that was trying to conceal marital assets. And the basis for Mr. Cassano's defense was that he had no knowledge that that these funds were criminally derived. However, the government didn't have any evidence to dispel this theory of defense, so they relied on their closing arguments.
Well, other than the common sense and inferences that they draw from the evidence, your whole defense was that he was just some dupe, had no idea what was going on.
Exactly.
Do you really believe that? I mean, a person can cash checks for a third party, and he gets paid for it, and he doesn't think anything's wrong?
Well, certainly. I mean, I'm not saying that it was proper or ethical, but, I mean, it's an understandable theory, and I'm sure it happens every day. People set out to, in contested divorce cases, conceal assets, and they can often use other people to accomplish that objective.
And that third party who's cashing the checks and is getting paid for cashing the checks thinks that everything's on the up and up.
Exactly. I mean, and what he was paid wouldn't indicate to an individual that something illegal is happening here. When you're cashing...
Then why wouldn't the party cash him himself?
Because he needed to launder the funds through another party.
So. Well, but, I mean, isn't the whole divorce story really made implausible, Mr. Myers, given that the fictitious Mr. Reinhardt is signing the very checks that he's purportedly trying to hide from his wife?
Exactly, but if you look at the checks themselves and how they're made out, they were made out from Eagle Mailing, that is the company owned by the individual trying to conceal the assets, made out to another company called Precision Data.
These false companies that don't
both,
exist.
Both false companies.
That don't exist.
But I mean, if these checks were discovered by the opposing spouse, one could argue, well, these are checks that are being made, represent transfers of funds from one company owned by Mr. Reinhart to another company owned by Mr. Reinhart. So that single factor would not indicate to an individual that something was wrong here.
But, of course, if one were to credit Mr. White's testimony that he never received any of the $42,000 in proceeds from the checks that Mr. Cassano cashed for him while Mr. White was in jail, couldn't the jury infer that Mr. Cassano kept the money himself and therefore is a full and knowing participant in the scheme?
I mean, that's one conclusion a jury could reach. I would submit to this court that that's an unreasonable conclusion when you look at the fact that Mr. Cassano later asked for payment from Mr. White and got $100 to $300 per check.
$100 to $600 per check, isn't it?
Maybe five.
Yeah, not five, six. $100 to $600.
Well,
per check.
Yeah, whatever. But I mean, that indicates that prior to that, he hadn't received any money.
Why? He may be a very greedy person.
But I mean, is Mr. Reinhart or Mr. White going to allow Mr. Cassano to keep $42,000 when all he's doing is negotiating the check? I think that's highly implausible. But I see my time is up unless there's any other questions.
Well, there's another minute if you have something that you need to leave in you want to tell us.
Aside from the fact, the government also misstated the evidence. I mean, besides the facts, misstated the law. And I'm referring to the government's inference that all they had to prove with was that the money was dirty, which diminished the government's burden of proof and unfairly prejudiced the defendant. And then lastly, the government was allowed to argue that because Mr. White had approached two other individuals and those individuals had declined to cash the checks, that somehow knowledge could be inferred to Mr. Cassano, and I believe that was improper.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Thank you.
I looked at the government's brief and our brief and my reply brief, and I decided that rather than trying to explain everything that was there, I wanted to point to something that maybe we all may have overlooked as we were writing the brief. And that is actually in the abstract. And in the abstract is at A55 and A56. It's a footnote. And that's a footnote in an opinion that was prepared by Judge Manning when she refused to dismiss this case based upon our representation to the court that the government was not going to be able to prove that my client knowingly involved himself in a fraud on the CNA. If you look at that footnote, and I'd like to take a moment just to read it. I know you don't like us reading things from the brief, but I looked at it and I thought it might be appropriate. Williams cites United States versus Levin, 973, Fed Second at 463, in support of its contention that the indictment should be dismissed under Rule 12B. Levin, however, is distinguishable from the instant case. In Levin, the court upheld the dismissal of many counts in an indictment because it was undisputed that a government agent told the defendants that their conduct was legal. And therefore, as a matter of law, the defendants lacked the requisite criminal intent. CNA gave Clarence Cross the right to speak for it. Cross was CNA's agent. Not only do we have apparent authority, the evidence showed that he had actual authority to hire vendors. Now, the fact that Cross is not telling one of the vendors what the deal is with respect to his principal, how is Williams to be held responsible for that? Cross had the apparent authority, he had the actual authority to hire vendors and to cut a deal with them. And that's what he did with Williams.
But Mr. Hill, even if Mr. Cross told Mr. Williams that he simply wanted Mr. Williams to take the credit as a minority contractor for work that other companies were doing, wasn't that in and of itself a fraudulent scheme? who would think it was legitimate to get paid over $1 million for work someone else is doing?
We introduced evidence that he, at the time of the trial, was doing just that. He had another, he wasn't making as much, but he had a situation where majority companies needed to show minority participations in their operation for whatever reason. There was no law against doing it. They chose to do that. All that he knew was that CNA wanted to have a minority face in their operation. The guy who brought them this deal had the actual and apparent authority to do it. Williams said, okay, maybe this is a form of affirmative action that CNA is putting forth.
Where someone gives you $1 million for doing no work?
No, he thought that he was doing invoicing for companies. You have many companies that do nothing but...
$1 million worth for invoicing?
Well, he didn't... Well, what
he was pretty high paid, don't you think?
Well, maybe, but that was the deal that he was given by the agent for the principal. I mean, everybody... If Williams is guilty, all of the employees that got paid who were supposed to be watching the shop at CNA should also be guilty. I mean, they got paid not to do anything, because if they had, $1 million wouldn't have left CNA. I mean, you've got them signing checks. You've got them authorizing payroll. They give Williams 1.3. Nobody ever questions it. But he's trying to take care of his sick father and his family. He thinks that he's gotten a blessing from heaven after all of his hard work. Now, there wasn't one bit of evidence to rebut that. Now, granted, maybe he was negligent. Maybe he should have said, well, this is too good to be true, but the law says that negligence is not enough. Judges, what I'm saying is that the government put it all on him. You got too much money. You did it because you were black. You were, and that ain't right. But companies were playing on that. You have minority set-asides throughout this country, and everybody says you're getting too much for what you're doing. That's what he assumed was happening with CNA. And what makes it so egregious...
Well, tell me this. Is it a could it be possibly a fair inference, given that his company did little, if any, work for CNA, got over $1 million for it, that he was a full and knowing participant in a scheme to defraud CNA? Could a jury believe such a thing?
Not when Cross is telling, by law, this is a law case, Judge. It never should have gotten to the jury. That's why I'm taking you back to Levin. Respectfully, our motion for judgment of acquittal, which is why we're here asking you to look at this de novo and decide whether or not, as a matter of, it never should have gotten to the jury. They did not establish criminal intent. They established negligence, but Cross was the authorized agent for CNA.
Why did they establish negligence and not criminal intent?
Why did they...
How did they do it?
Well, I'll tell you what the negligence... I'll tell you what the negligence...
Is it Williams is only negligent?
What I'm saying
is... the evidence shows?
But I'm saying at most you've got negligence, and the negligence responds to Judge Rovner's question about... And Judge Coffey's question about, aren't you getting paid too much for what you're doing?
Nobody asked you that.
I'm saying that I would suggest that many companies, several companies, seldom ask, are they getting paid too much for the work that they're doing? They're asking for more, usually. That is not a reasonable question for Williams. Are you paying me too much to do the job?
That's not what we asked you.
I'm sorry.
We asked you...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be...
Did you get paid $1 million for doing nothing?
He did not. He thought that he was doing invoicing. He was told that was the deal, invoicing. You do invoicing for these companies that are over here doing the work, because we want them doing the work, not the invoicing. Everybody had a role. You do the mailing, you do the printing, you do the invoicing. And that's what Williams thought he was doing, and I didn't mean to...
Thank you. We've heard your argument.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Well, you've got your point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. I'm Patrick Cotter, and I represent Clarence Cross. Respectfully, Your Honor, I think you all just got a taste of what Clarence Cross got during the entire trial. Mr. Hill, this was a small taste of what happened to Clarence Cross at this trial, because as we say in our appeal to this court, The trial court erred when it denied Clarence Cross's motion for severance at trial when it became apparent that Mr. Williams' attorney was going to engage in a full frontal assault and act as a second and, if I may add, a very effective prosecutor in this case, prosecuting Clarence Cross, because indeed that was Williams' defense. In doing so, Mr. Hill, on behalf of Mr. Williams, and by the way, we do not criticize Mr. Hill. He's doing his job.
Yeah, but it's not unusual in joint trials for one defendant to claim the other, somebody else was most involved, or he was a dupe or whatever. What's different here from any other joint defendant trial case?
Here's what's different, Your Honor, and this is what makes this case extraordinary. What's different is that Mr. Hill didn't simply content himself with arguing from the evidence that the government produced that, hey, maybe Clarence Cross is more guilty than we are. No, in fact, he introduced new evidence, evidence the government not only didn't seek to introduce, but which they said before trial, on the record, they would not seek to introduce, which the court, at the time it was admitted, said this is inadmissible double or triple hearsay, depending on how you count it. He went far beyond arguing from the evidence or pointing fingers. He introduced new evidence. And this was devastating evidence, Your Honor. This was not simply some evidence. This was statements elicited from a government witness on Cross. The government didn't try and introduce this. He did.
Of course, Mr. Cross had the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Williams, did he not?
Well, as it turned out, at the time that the inadmissible triple hearsay was admitted, which, by the way, Your Honors, just so we're clear, what that evidence was, it was supposedly statements made by Mr. Cross admitting to kickbacks, to setting up this whole scheme, telling Mr. Williams what to do. At the time it was admitted, nobody knew whether Mr. Williams was going to testify. Now, it is true, after it was admitted, the court asked the question as to whether or not Mr. Williams would testify. Mr. Hill, quite candidly, in a sidebar, told the court, yes, and if he gets a chance, he's going to repeat the hearsay. This time it'll only be double hearsay. It won't be triple, it'll be double. So that's what he did. He testified.
When he did it, wasn't
yes,
he also subject to exhaustive cross-examination?
No, Your Honor. He was subject to cross-examination. As you will note in our brief, the cross-examination lasted only a couple pages, did not touch on the hearsay at all, and most of the defense. Your Honor, I put it to this court, and indeed, as this court said in Hernandez versus Cohen, Hernandez versus Cowan, the mere fact of the opportunity of cross-examination may not cure the severe prejudice done when a co-defendant testifies in a way that directly implicates the co-defendant he is talking about. And in this case, Your Honor, cross-examination of Williams on this point clearly would have done nothing except give him a third opportunity to state that, yes, Mr. Cross told me what to do, Mr. Cross demanded kickbacks, Mr. Cross, Mr. Cross, Mr. Cross. It would have done nothing. As this court noted in Hernandez versus Cowan, simply allowing the defense the futile opportunity to say, are you sure that my client told you what to do and is in fact the mastermind of this entire scheme? Are you sure about that? Yes, let me tell you again, sir. That's all that would have happened here, because this was a joint trial. And as the court noted in Hernandez, had this been a separate trial, not only would this inadmissible hearsay never have gotten before this jury, because indeed, as the government candidly said, both before trial and at the time the evidence came in, that they intentionally stayed away from this inadmissible hearsay. Not only that, but had there been a separate trial, there would have been no need to do this. Mr. Williams certainly wasn't going to testify for the government at Mr. Cross's trial, and God forbid if he had, it certainly would have been with the benefit of a deal. And as this court noted in Hernandez, that changes the opportunity for cross-examination dramatically, because it makes cross-examination meaningful.
Was the severance motion renewed?
No, Your Honor, it was not. And that's why in our brief we candidly admit to the court that the standard of review here is plain error. It is not abuse of discretion. And that's because
why wasn't it renewed? Was it an inference that it was so bad at that time that you didn't think about renewing it?
Your Honor, I was not the trial counsel, and I have no idea why it wasn't renewed. I will tell the court this. There is absolutely no evidence in the record to suggest that there was in any sense an a knowing or strategic decision to waive. Indeed, the government cites none in their brief. They simply say, well, maybe it was. There's no evidence of that. The trial counsel argued this motion vociferously for, I think it was 7 or 8 pages of the trial record. He did not renew it at the end of the government's case or the end of the evidence. I don't know why he did, but what that results in, Your Honor, is a forfeiture, not a waiver. There's no evidence pursuant to the standards set out in Olano that he waived. Your Honor, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, unless there's further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, please.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning.
Good morning.
Your Honor, before responding to the specific arguments made by my opponents, I think it's important to put in perspective those arguments. And Your Honor has actually done a better job of that than I could possibly do. The perspective is that the evidence at trial was, with respect to the defendant's conduct, was overwhelming and largely uncontroverted. The question that the jury had to decide was whether the defendants acted with requisite knowledge or whether they should believe the proffered innocent explanations provided by the defendant. Mr. Cassano argues that the government engaged in prosecutorial misconduct and he raises in his brief a variety of small points.
One of the small points would be, I suppose, with respect to Mr. Cassano, why was it relevant that two other people had turned down Mr. White's request for assistance? In other words, if the jury wanted, or rather if the government wanted the jury to draw inferences about the reasons why those two people turned Mr. White down, shouldn't the government have put those two people on the stand?
Well, Your Honor, the relevance is actually the proper argument or objection that should have been made during the trial. As a matter of fact, at trial, the objection that was made was hearsay. And the evidence was admitted over the hearsay objection because, of course, the evidence was not hearsay. It was not offered for the truth. With respect to the relevance, the relevance becomes clear when looking at the prosecutor's argument, which is in response to Mr. Cassano's argument that Mr. Cassano's conduct was absolutely reasonable in light of all the circumstances, and that he not only believed that he was only cashing checks for as a favor to the friend of a friend, but that it was perfectly reasonable for him to believe that and to believe that there was absolutely nothing wrong with that. Mr. Cassano's defense was this is what he believed, and it was reasonable for him to believe that. The prosecutor argued it's not what he believed, and it's not even reasonable, it's not even plausible, it's not credible that he believed that, and used as an example the other two people who had turned down the offer by Mr. White. Now, in the prosecutor's argument, this was a very small point. This isn't something that was dwelt on or focused on by the government at all. It was simply part of the argument that Cassano's defense, as well as Mr. Williams' defense, were just not credible. They didn't make sense, and the jury should reject them.
Yeah, but the problem with that argument, Ms. Bonamici, is that we never know what it is that catches the jury's fancy. Well, to start parading in, you know, all of these people who, not parade them in, you didn't bring them in. You know, this one turned it down, that one turned it down.
The issue is, I think, Your Honor, the issue in this case was whether the jury should believe Mr. Cassano when he defends on the basis that this was his mindset. The government's primary argument was that's not true. That's not what was going on, and the jury can tell by Mr. Cassano's behavior that is not what was going on. It's not that Mr. Cassano actually did believe that, but that was unreasonable. That was not the thrust of the government's argument, nor was it even the thrust of the defense case. The thrust was this was a cover story. This isn't the truth.
That's why you didn't need to bring stuff like that in, and you don't need to do it in these cases.
Well, given that, accepting that as the reality of the case, What's clear in this case is that there's absolutely no way, because it's such a small point, there's no way that it had, that one point had a significant impact on the jury's deliberations in light of all of the other evidence against Mr. Cassano. Now, Mr. Williams argues that Mr. Cross had apparent and actual authority to hire vendors and that somehow that made everything okay. With respect to the Levin case, which relates to statements made by a government agent, there's no relevance to that case whatsoever. It's completely inapplicable on the facts. But the question with respect to Mr. Williams was whether he knew that this was a fraud, not whether Mr. Cross had apparent or actual authority to get checks. That's a given. We know he had the authority to get checks. He abused his authority by getting them for illicit purposes. That's the whole case. Finally, with respect to Mr. Cross, Mr. Cross's primary argument is that the court erred in denying severance. He focused in his brief in argument on the evidence of the out-of-court statements made by Mr. Williams, which were elicited primarily by Mr. Williams during the trial. Well, as Your Honor pointed out, that whole issue was resolved when Mr. Williams took the stand, and his out-of-court statements became in-court statements, and he was subject to cross-examination. This is not a case like Hernandez versus Cowan, where, in essence, the government's only evidence was the accusatory testimony of the co-defendant.
Well, you concede that you got some help from Mr. Williams' counsel?
Well, here's how I would view it, Your Honor. I think this is a case where if each of the defendants was permitted to put before the jury their own version of the event, without the messy complication of having to deal with their co-defendants putting forward some inconsistent details, they probably would have had a better chance of acquittal. But that's not the test. The law makes clear that our system of justice is a search for truth, not gimmicks. And the jury had the right to hear both versions of events in order to make a better, a more reliable determination of guilt or innocence in this case than they would have been able to make had they heard only one of the defendant's story.
When did Cross make his motion to sever?
Cross?
Yes.
Cross didn't make his motion to sever until the conclusion, the conclusion of Mr. Enrion's testimony.
Would you say that was then timely or untimely?
No, it was untimely.
Right.
It was plainly untimely. And as we pointed out in the brief, the motion was also not renewed at the close of evidence, which
Pardon me?
The motion was not renewed at the close of evidence,
right,
which
right,
would have been
right.
The best time for the district court to evaluate the whole
mm-hmm.
situation. For all the reasons that I've argued and all of the reasons that we've set forth in our brief, the government does request respectfully that Your Honors affirm the convictions of all three defendants in this case.
All right, counsel. Thank you. How much time do you have? 1 minute, sir.
Your Honor, the motion was timely made. This prejudice only became evident when co-counsel brought it up. It was not possible to know about it. This is not a situation where the government had proffered evidence or we knew the government was going to bring in evidence that was going to create a problem. The minute it came up, was during the cross-examination. That's when the motion for severance was made. The government says that the issue with this
didn't
trial is...
Didn't you anticipate any of that?
Excuse me?
Didn't you anticipate, or didn't the other counsel anticipate any of that?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The record is... I see my time is up. May I respond?
Sure.
Your Honor, absolutely not. The record is absolutely clear that it was only on the morning of jury selection that for the first time counsel for Mr. Williams said that
he made that motion at that time, before trial.
As the record is very clear, Your Honor, no one, including the judge, this is not just counsel for Cross, including the judge, no one realized what was going to come in. As the judge herself said, as Judge Manning said at the time that the motion for severance was made, she said, well, clearly, counsel for Cross is not clairvoyant. He couldn't have seen, I believe she said, he couldn't possibly have known what was going to come out from Mr. Williams' counsel. He couldn't possibly have known. And that's what the court said. So everybody in the courtroom was shocked and surprised.
The government themselves said that they thought that what Mr. Williams' counsel was doing was going into hideous detail. They said they had tried to stay away from it. Everybody in the courtroom was stunned by it, and that's when the motion was made, Your Honor. I think it was entirely timely.
Did you object at that time and ask the court at the time to expunge that evidence and to tell the jury to disregard it?
Counsel objected. Counsel asked for a mistrial. Sidebar was held.
The jury? No, that's not what I asked you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you ask the court to set aside the said testimony and tell the jury to disregard it?
No, Your Honor, and indeed...
That's what counsel should have done, isn't that true?
Your Honor, there may be many things counsel should have done, but our argument is that the court erred when it failed to do its duty under Rule 14 to make sure that this joint trial did not rob Clarence Cross of his constitutional right to a fair trial. And that's what it did when it didn't give that instruction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will take the case under advisement and proceed to case number 3, please. Hostie et al. Versus Carter et al. All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of Dean Carter. Dean Carter is entitled to qualified immunity on this First Amendment claim for two reasons. The first is that plaintiffs, one is that plaintiffs did not prove that the law with regard to college students' First Amendment rights for student-sponsored...
Her red light is on, please.
...for student-sponsored publications was clearly established at the time that Dean Carter made her phone calls, or even today, for that matter. And the other reason is that the plaintiffs failed to provide enough evidence to support a jury finding on each element of a prior restraint claim. Your Honor, the qualified immunity question, the fundamental question, is whether every reasonable university administrator, would have been compelled to conclude that Dean Carter's conduct, her phone calls to the printer, were unconstitutional.
Didn't Carter admit that a college newspaper is a public forum?
I don't think she did, Your Honor, and even if she had, she's not a court. I mean, I don't think her opinion...
You're talking about her theory of the case.
Right. In her theory of it? You mean in the briefs, Your Honor? Or do you mean Dean Carter herself?
In the court.
I'm sorry?
Didn't she admit that a college newspaper is a public forum?
She herself? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Do you mean she herself or in the briefs? She herself?
Yes.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. But even if she had, Your Honor, as I was saying, her view of whether the newspaper was a public forum in the legal sense, she's not a lawyer, wouldn't really matter. I mean, courts have to decide these questions, and these are very, very intensive, as the Hazelwood Court said, these are very fact-intensive inquiries.
What does the record tell us about control over the content of the innovator? Judge Conlon said that, here's what she said, that the student editors and writers are given complete editorial control over the newspaper, including its subject matter and content. Does the record support that conclusion?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does. The record says that, and this was undisputed, this is one of the undisputed facts, is that there was the common practice was that the advisor would sign off on the paper. Now, this protected the university, as Ms. Hoskey said in her deposition. This was designed to protect the university from liability. Obviously, the university, this is university-sponsored speech. The innovator's subtitle is the newspaper of Governor State University.
Okay, even if the faculty advisor had to sign off on each issue of the paper before it's submitted to the printer, is there evidence in the record suggesting that he or she, well, it was he had the ultimate power to determine content, or was he simply an advisor?
He was an advisor, but he had sign-off, and the sign-off power as, and there was apparently another level of sign-off as well, according to the evidence. And this level of sign-off power, there's no evidence in the record to show that the paper could have gone, the publisher could have printed it without this sign-off. And again, whether Dean
Carter... Sign-off means to approve everything in the paper.
That's my understanding. I mean, there's nothing in the record that contradicts that.
Well, yes, there might be, and mm-hmm. let me see.
Okay.
Because Ms. According to Ms. Hosty, the Innovator historically has been totally student-run.
Mm-hmm.
That was the quote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on summary judgment, don't we have to credit that testimony, and doesn't that evidence suggest that the Innovator is, or at least might be, a limited public forum? And, I mean, as the editor of the paper, doesn't she have personal knowledge of that subject?
Your Honor, even if that were true, even if there were evidence to support the limited public forum, which frankly I do not think there is, but if the court disagrees, that doesn't change the analysis either for the merits or for the qualified immunity analysis. You have to look at what the landscape was in 2000. In 2000, what you had was Hazelwood, which said school-sponsored publications when they're...
High school.
Right. But
Isn't
Hazelwood...
Isn't that a big difference here?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that a big difference?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court was very careful. They said, we don't have to decide right now whether this is what we would also apply to college students. And then, in 1999, a year before Dean Carter's phone calls, the Sixth Circuit came out with the Kincaid decision. And what the Sixth Circuit said was that not just review and approval, but that the university could confiscate the yearbook there based on form and content objections. So that's the only post-Hazelwood university case on a similar subject. The only case after Dean Carter's phone calls is the Brown case from just this last August, where you have three different decisions from the Ninth Circuit judges. The one says that the Hazelwood, the forum analysis applies to the student's thesis, that the school could censor the student's thesis based on objections to its content. Judge Reinhart said, this is an open question. We don't know what the standard is for First Amendment rights for college students. And if it's an open question in the Ninth Circuit, there's no evidence that there's no law to show that it's a closed question in the Seventh Circuit or in the United States Supreme Court, or that there's any kind of consensus. The Sixth Circuit flip-flopped on this question. I mean, went a total reversal of opinion. And that's because this is a very, very fact-based inquiry. And if you all, both the first Kincaid court, the panel said, this is a non-public forum. You look at the supervision, you look at the policy of the university. Now, here the policy of the university, and there's no question about this, is that the advisor got to sign off. And our contention is that there is no constitutional distinction between Dean Carter saying, we want someone from the administration to sign off, and there being an advisor signing off. There simply is not. Now, also, as to the merits, I'd just like to make a few points. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. There's no evidence that the speech that was being suggested was constitutionally protected. The plaintiffs are saying they have the First Amendment right to write anything they want in the student newspaper of the university. This is simply not true. There's no constitutional right to deceptive speech. There's no constitutional right to slander. There's no constitutional right to quite a few things. In addition, there's no evidence that they were denied access. There's a giant constitutional difference between review and denial of access. Furthermore, there's no evidence that there was a content-based discrimination. Ms. Porcher said at her deposition at page 180 and 181, she had never been told that she could not write, that they could not write about a subject by any defendant. Ms. Porcher said that the defendants did not know whether the defendants knew about the investigations, and that's at page 126, I believe, and 24 of her deposition. So, Your Honor, there's no evidence to support every element of the prior restraint claim, and the law is so unsettled in this area that we would like this court to give us guidance when it reverses the entry of summary judgment for Dean Carter.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Counsel, Your Honors, on behalf of the amici, we appreciate the opportunity to appear before this Court and present oral arguments in support of the position for the students at Governor State, the plaintiffs'